Good afternoon, Carolyn Blanchard for Mr. Lambert. I'd first like to address the motions for mistrial and new trial motions, and my second and third motions, in that in each of these issues, the judge relied on incorrect information to make his decision. So it's, I argue, it's a direct abuse of discretion, and therefore, as based on Waddell, it's reversible error. And the first issue, back to jail, which the sister said, and then the prosecutor said in final, almost the last few words of her argument, that is so prejudicial to Mr. Lambert because it introduced the issue that he had a prior record. And that's has to be combined with the issue of the parole officer coming in and testifying that he was issued, jury wasn't of course told he was a parole officer, but he was able to issue a warrant for Mr. Lambert's arrest. And circumstantially, this jury could combine these things and perceive that Mr. Lambert did have a prior record.
What kind of a record are you talking about? An arrest record or a felony record?
Well, that he was in jail. Back to jail. That's what the jury heard. The jury didn't know. The jury couldn't tell, except why would a man be having to go see another man every month for about a year and a half? And this man was able to issue a warrant for his arrest, for Mr. Lambert's arrest, if Mr. Lambert wasn't accused of some serious crime. I think a jury would perceive that Mr. Lambert had some kind of serious criminal record in the past.
I'd like to understand the record. As I understand it, the sister made a comment about going back to jail. And then in the prosecutor's closing argument, those particular words, going back to jail, were only stated once. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct. And but prior to that, the prosecutor had argued or had spoken to the jury, Mr. Lambert didn't want to go back to jail or go to jail.
No. That's the reason for my question.
Excuse me. No.
They said just going to jail.
Going to jail, but that was 25 times.
And the obvious purpose here is that what the prosecutor is trying to do is establish that Mr. Lambert has basically made up his mind that he is not going to jail, and that the reason for this is going to inform his state of mind when he finally interacts with the police officer. It would be relevant to establish that he acted with intent and after deliberation. And that's the obvious point of the prosecution's argument, right?
Not true.
Okay. My question is then, so what do you make of all this? How significant can it be in light of the fact that the jury acquitted Mr. Lambert of acting deliberately and after intent, and instead convicted him merely of second-degree murder? How prejudicial could it have been?
Well, it negated his defense of self-defense, and that it diminished it significantly, because the jury then could perceive he was streetwise, he should have known this was a police officer approaching him. And I think, the issue is self-defense. And if Mr. Lambert's saying, I didn't know who this man was, I didn't know what was happening, and it really had nothing to do with going back to jail as far as a self-defense. His self-defense issue is concerned. His self-defense issue was someone approached him from behind, he didn't know who or what it was, and he was afraid for his life. And I would say, muddle it up with the issue of his prior record was prejudicial.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. As to the 404B evidence, well, I think I essentially addressed it, that the second warrant issue, the judge was wrong in saying, the judge said, He wrote in correctly that the DA requested the evidence be admitted to show lack of mistake and state of mind. And that's not what the DA argued, that the evidence should be admitted. And he also ruled inadmissible, that it should be admissible because Mr. Lambeth wanted to avoid parole revocation. But here, the parole officer had already revoked his parole, and Mr. Lambeth didn't know if a warrant was issued for violation of parole or not. And furthermore, even the police officers never testified anything about knowing he had a parole warrant violation. They were after Mr. Lambeth because of the assault on the sister and that warrant for his arrest.
So let me get this straight. There's no evidence that that even the police officers knew about this other warrant.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any dispute that he knew a warrant existed for the assault on sister?
No, because he had some newspaper article, I guess, in his pocket when he was arrested.
There's no question he knew about that.
Correct.
Okay. So what's the prejudice?
Well, two warrants. Two warrants is more than one warrant. I think as a juror would...
But again, this goes to his state of mind, right?
Well,
so what's the prejudice of the parole warrant?
It makes him look like a bad man in front of the jury. It's not about his knowledge. It's about what the jury perceives Mr. Lambeth to be, a bad man, a streetwise person, somebody that deserves a punishment. And back to the new trial motion and the mistrial motions, the judge has to look at all of the evidence, and and the judge never considered the evidence of this, the second warrant, when he looked at the facts of the case and made his decision that, oh, the back jail statement wasn't important, or well, he actually denied it existed. Okay. Then the judge's erroneous instruction number 21. We, of course, argue that this was very prejudicial and that the judge wouldn't state on what statute he made this this jury instruction up on, and it was essentially contradictory to the self-defense instruction, and the law on self-defense doesn't give an exception for police.
How explain how you see it as contradictory, because it seems to me it's showing by the circumstances of this case how the limits on the use of self-defense, i.e. the reasonableness.
Well, the case law says that the self-defense instructions are to be crafted for the defense's defense, not the prosecutor's accusations.
That's a reasonableness question, isn't it?
Reasonableness of the instruction?
No, of the belief.
The defendant's actions under the circumstances. So, in other words, how can the defendant's actions be reasonable under the circumstances if the defendant knows that the officer is a police officer, and if the jury already has found that the officer didn't use excessive force? How is it possible that the defendant's actions could be objectively reasonable under those circumstances?
That's under the Fuller case.
Well.
And let me add something, because I'd like you to clarify this. Even taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, somebody, the officer walked up and placed his hand on the shoulder. Coming from behind, may not have seen.
But I don't think those are the facts of the case.
Okay, why don't you clarify it then for me, please?
The one witness that the woman that was walking around her house said, grab by the arm. Or there was a dragging on the arm. So I don't believe there was a touching on the shoulder. Because that's about all the facts we have about what happened, if we can believe that.
So then, follow up with the answer to the question, the reasonableness question here. In a typical self-defense, it's reasonable to use a gun in that circumstance?
Well...
And that's putting aside the question that this is a police officer. In just a straight self-defense instruction.
Well, the self-defense instruction said you are permitted to use deadly physical force if you reasonably believe that that's the amount of force needed to counteract what's happening to you.
Okay.
So, if the problem with the judge's instruction is reasonably believe that the man was a police officer.
What evidence is there of that? You were talking about the woman looking out the window, seeing what's going on. What evidence is there to that defendant reasonably believe that the officer was using unreasonable or excessive force? If he just apparently just touched his arm or even pulled on his arm.
Well, if you look at the photographs, the bench where Mr. Lambert is sitting, let's say, is at this podium, but the officer's body was found about over at this column here. So, you know, maybe 10 feet away. So how did Mr. Lambert get from the bench to 10 feet away from the bench?
Was there testimony that the defendant was where the officer was found?
I don't believe so.
I think it's in that part of the problem.
Yes, that is part of the problem. But that's why the evidence of this going back to jail and the parole officer's testimony was so prejudicial to my client. Because it made him look like a bad man in the eyes of the jury. That he had a prior conviction, that he should know what's going on here. I think I'll reserve. That's the best answer I could give. Thank you.
About 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I notice the clock has not started. There it goes. I would first like to thank this Court for continuing this oral argument to allow the victim's family members and friends and fellow officers to be here. As this Court can probably tell, quite a few members of his family and friends and fellow officers are here in support of Detective Jensen. Counsel first started off discussing the mistrial and the 404B race justice issues, and I think the case law and the facts are pretty straightforward on those issues. I think clearly the sister and the prosecutor made the misstatement on one occasion each that the defendant didn't want to go back to jail. There was no contemporaneous objection made to either of those comments, so in fact the prosecutor's argument is reviewed for plain error. But even reviewing both in the context of a request for a mistrial, which is essentially what the defendant is asking, the motion for a new trial is a vehicle to raise certain claims, and the claim is the denial of a mistrial or prosecutorial misconduct in making the argument. And I think since the comments, the court properly found the comments were brief, were made once, there was no reference to any felony, which might imply prison time, there was no reference to any conviction. It could have been an arrest on a child support one, a misdemeanor, any number of things. And so certainly we've seen many more cases addressing the denial of a mistrial where much worse was said. So I think the case law on those issues is very straightforward. And unless this court has any further questions, what I would like to do is ask this court if it has any concerns or any questions that it would like to address the people with regard to either the discovery issue or the self-defense issues.
I would like to ask one more question about this mistrial issue. I had thought that the logical thrust of this evidence, if it were considered at all by the jury, would be to evaluate the defendant's state of mind at the time this incident occurred. But your colleague here has suggested that it could have affected the jury's evaluation of the defendant's theory of defense of self-defense. So I wonder if you might comment on that and address whether it would have any logical effect on the determination of self-defense.
Frankly, I think it would tend to defeat the defendant's claim of self-defense in light of the instructions given. If the defendant knew he was wanted for an arrest, he didn't want to go back to jail, it made it more likely that he knew that the stranger approaching him was a police officer. So I don't think it has anything to do to help his claim of self-defense. I heard no argument, I heard no logical explanation as to why it would do that. And frankly, if anything, I think it defeats the claim of self-defense, the state of mind.
Okay, thank you.
Does this court have any questions with regard to the discovery issues? Or any of the issues, I'd briefly like to note with regard to the discovery issue, the case law supports the factual scenario that happened here where the defendant made a blanket request for preservation of basically all evidence. And the prosecution said, we will preserve all evidence and it will be, duplicates will be provided upon request. And that's what's required by the rule. Apparently, he did not request it. Not only did he not request it, so I don't believe there's a discovery violation at all, and clearly the prosecution's response to the motion for new trial indicated that it was all over the discovery. There was a specific discovery bait stamp on it. It was mentioned in the evidence log, and it was mentioned, the fact that it was videotaped was mentioned in the officer's reports.
I thought there was a specific request by the defendant for videos.
There was a blanket request for preservation and production of all tapes, 911 dispatch. It was basically your standard discovery request. And the prosecution's response was, we will preserve and produce these upon request. And I think the idea...
Why wasn't that a request?
Because it was a request for production and preservation, not for making duplicate copies. And the rule specifically says that if duplicates need to be made only upon request. So basically, I think the idea is that you may have, especially in a case like this, thousands of recordings, 911 calls, dispatch recordings, all kinds of physical, dictation from officers, all kinds of interviews, things like that. And so the prosecution was saying, look, we will provide all of this evidence and anything you want upon request. And I don't believe that the blanket request at first was a request for duplicates, which is contemplated by the rule.
Is it your response that the prosecution's initial response would have authorized the defense to come over and listen to or observe any of these things, the originals?
Yes.
Okay. So that...
And
okay.
I would assume they did, because there was quite a few recordings introduced. There were several 911, several dispatch recordings, and at no point did the defendant indicate, wait, I don't have those.
And do you understand the defendant to be making a Brady claim now?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe he's making both a rule and a Brady claim, arguably not particularly fleshed out, but of course, as I argued in the brief, even if there was somehow an obligation or on the part of the prosecution to sua sponte provide duplicate copies, or even if the blanket request could be construed as a request for duplicate copies of everything, there's no prejudice here. The recording itself, first of all, the defendant never asked for continuance. He didn't even object at the time of trial. In fact, he used the absence of this video to his advantage. And so arguably, as I indicated in my brief, this is waived. But to the extent it's not, certainly it's reviewed for plain error. And what we have was Detective Geisen testifying at one point during the trial, there was a videotape made. And at that point, there was no objection made. At that point, at the end of trial that day, which I believe there were six more days of trial, there was even a discussion between the defense or with the defense at the end of the day outside the presence of the jury, indicating that the defense counsel was going to meet with Detective Geisen, go over any additional materials that needed to be obtained. And so apparently it wasn't requested at that point. There was six more days of trial. He could have asked for a continuance. He could have said, wait a minute, I've never got this. Even if by some reason his attorney missed the references in the discovery, which were there, and he didn't. And he waited until after arguably this is a strategic decision considering the argument that was made. And as we know from Stewart, it's where it's a strategic decision, it's considered waived. But in any event, if you look at listen to the recording itself, which is actually, I must admit, hard to do, it gave me motion sickness. But you listen to it all the way through, and I pointed out in the brief the exact times that you could actually hear the recording on the radio. And so not only would it was is there no prejudice, no request for continuance, no objection, he used it to his advantage. There's nothing in there that impeaches the testimony of either officer who indicated that they could hear. And they also explained they could hear the recording because they were in the area once all the first responders and the siren had left, the sirens were gone, the chaos was gone, and you can see that in the video.
I'm curious how a Brady claim can ever be subjected to plain error review. I mean, the defendant has to show prejudice as part of the claim. I've never heard of that before.
Well, I guess I was talking about it in the context of the discovery violation.
Okay. So that part of it, you're thinking, is subject to a plain error analysis.
Well, I think it's all waived.
Okay.
Because I think the substance of the absence of the videotape, if it gave rise to either a discovery violation or a Brady violation, was made known to the defendant at trial. And because of the events that ensued and the fact that he used absence to his advantage, it's both claims are waived.
That makes more sense. Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any other questions regarding...
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the instruction number 21.
Okay.
And how I'm not sure I have a full grasp of the issue, but instruction number 18 in the reasonableness question, how does instruction 21 change things?
Well, instruction 21 basically precludes consideration of any of the factors in instruction number 18 with regard to whether the defendant acted reasonably, used the proper amount of force.
Provided the defendant knew this was a police officer.
Right. It's a threshold determination. And it's important to know that in the self-defense statutes, you're not allowed to use self-defense if someone is acting lawfully. It requires unlawful conduct. And the cases recognize that. And what the court in Fuller recognized, and in Fuller and in Barris and Bacco, for all of those were issues where self-defense instructions were not given. But we have some guidance, and especially with Fuller. Basically, Fuller said in order to decide whether a defendant can use self-defense against a police officer, it has to be established that the officer was acting unlawfully. And in order to determine what is unlawful conduct on part of the officer, we look to 18.1707 for guidance. And the Fuller court specifically said that essentially defines what's unlawful conduct. And so what the court did here was say, as a matter of law, essentially, if the defendant knew it was a police officer or reasonably should have known, and the officer was using excessive force, you cannot consider whether the defendant's actions were reasonable or not under the self-defense statute.
Well, I'm curious about counsel's. I understand the logic here, and I understand how this instruction essentially comports with the holding in Fuller. But, you know, we have many cases saying that a proposition, while legally true, doesn't necessarily mean the truth of that proposition doesn't necessarily mean that it should be conveyed in a jury instruction. And I guess I'm wondering whether instruction 21 doesn't have the effect of essentially reinforcing the prosecution's theory, something that quite consistent with Instruction 18, the prosecutor could have stressed to the jury. Why did it need to be placed into an instruction?
Well, because the jury needed to know what constitutes unlawful. The jury needed to know that the defendant cannot simply say, well, I didn't know who this guy was, I didn't know what he was doing. I mean, if there's evidence, if the prosecution proves, and that's why, fortunately, they put the burden on the prosecution to prove this. If the defendant knew or should have known he was a police officer and the officer was not using excessive force, as a matter of law, you don't get to the issue of self-defense. And so without this instruction, the jury would be allowed to consider a self-defense claim that's not allowed by law.
My question is perhaps somewhat the same, but if you focus on the language of 21, it says you knew that he was an officer, reasonably you should have known. And then second, the detective was using reasonable force. But Fuller seems to say that you have to prove that defendant lacked a reasonable belief that the detective was using or about to use unreasonable force. And this instruction doesn't say anything about the defendant's perspective.
Right, because I think for the threshold determination of whether he's even entitled to claim self-defense, I don't think it is a subjective belief. I think, first of all, the whole...
Well, that's what Fuller says, isn't it? The defendant lacked a reasonable belief. What does that mean?
There's some discussion of that, and that's the language that's used in some of the other cases. But the Fuller court said, we hold that a self-defense instruction is required when evidence has presented, essentially, of unreasonable force, and that such conduct was unreasonable and excessive under the circumstances. So the specific holding of Fuller specifically says... was using unreasonable or excessive force, not whether the defendant believed it to be. And I think if you look at the language of this self-defense statute itself, we look at whether the officer or whether the defendant reasonably believed that this person was using or about to use unlawful physical force. I think a reasonable construction of that statute is that the reasonable belief has to be that the person was about to do something, not that the force was lawful or unlawful. So basically...
Wait a minute, let me get this straight, because this is surprising to me. Obviously, the central inquiry here, Fuller, has logical force only insofar as it bears on the defendant's assertion that he was acting objectively reasonably. Are you telling me that if the defendant reasonably apprehends that he's about to be subjected to unlawful force, that he may not do this if, in fact, the police officer was not going to use unlawful force or wasn't being the degree of force wasn't unlawful?
I believe that that's how it should be interpreted. I truly believe that. Otherwise, I think you're in a situation where you can have an officer exactly like this, does nothing. Literally did nothing to make the defendant believe he was going to use any force.
Well, then doesn't that bear on the reasonableness of the defendant's belief? If the officer does nothing, how can a defendant reasonably believe that he's about to be subjected to unlawful force?
Right, but I think as a matter of law, the way the statute reads is the reasonable belief has to go towards the use, not the unlawfulness of the conduct. I think as a matter of law, when we're dealing with police officers, if they are using proper force, self-defense is not available, regardless of the defendant's reasonable belief.
In Barris, a division of this court said, we conclude self-defense is an available defense against the charge of obstructing a peace officer when a defendant reasonably believes that unreasonable or excessive force is being used by the peace officer.
Correct, and that's the language used in Backover, and that's some of the language used in Fuller. But I would submit, first of all, that's dicta, because the propriety of an instruction and whether it's an absolute threshold, it was not at issue in those cases. And frankly, I'm not even sure it's at issue in this case, because the defendant didn't argue that the language of this instruction should have said reasonably believed that the officer was using excessive force. He had no complaint about the language of the instruction, just that it shouldn't be given at all. But I think in the event this court wants to address this issue as a whole, I do believe that the proper interpretation of Fuller and the self-defense statute requires that this court find that as a matter of law, regardless of whether the defendant reasonably believed the force was excessive or not, if it was not, he's not entitled to act in self-defense.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As to the need for an objection to the prosecutor's statement back to jail, what would be the, what could the defense object to? Because the jury heard the sister say back to jail. You can't say it's not in evidence. I don't know what the objection would have been if the objection was made contemporaneously. And as to the tape wasn't produced until after trial at some point. So even if the defense counsel had gone over and looked at all this discovery, it wouldn't have been there. The tape wouldn't have even been there to see. So
are you saying that the defendant didn't know about the existence of this video until trial?
That's my belief from reading the record on appeal. I didn't speak with defense counsel.
Did defense counsel request a continuance to review?
No, sir. No.
And is it your position that the tape as it exists now is materially exculpatory?
Right, because it's when a man comes up behind my client and did whatever he did, drags him away or grabs his arm, but my client can't see them, and the jury says, well, was there a videotape? Was there sound there? And so the other way a person would perceive another person is by sound. And so the defense didn't have this sound information because the video wasn't there, wasn't even produced. And they asked for it. And I don't know how many times one must ask for something to get something, but...
So if the tape had been played, do you think this would have made a difference in the trial? The jury would have acquitted your client?
Well, I think first, the defense had a right to hear this information before trial and to evaluate, can somebody really hear this from 10 to 12 feet away? They could have prepared for this...
And wasn't it incumbent upon him to request a continuance, a recess, something to go listen?
Well, that certainly is a factor, and that's many cases say that he should have asked for a continuance. Yes, I'll agree with that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel for their arguments. That was helpful. This case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.